Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's June 7th, 2016, the day of the California primary, and it's happening in five other states, too. But to deliver the coronation to Hillary Clinton, America's corporate media has suffered from premature ejaculation. And it's a slimy mess.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes. Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game when there's rioting in the streets. It's just another movie, another song and dance, another poor sucker who never had a chance.
Yeah, just another song and dance for a Bernie Sanders, another poor sucker who didn't have a chance. And I've known all along, over the past year, that Bernie Sanders needed some big breaks in order to wrest the nomination away from Hillary Clinton. But even I am shocked at the manner in which this has occurred. The night before the critical California primary, and I'm not ignoring the other states, the Dakotas, Montana, New Mexico, New Jersey, those voters have been told, we don't need you. We've made the decision for you. And I have to say that, you know, I'm a guy who's been watching elections since Nixon was president. I consider myself kind of hard-nosed and cold-blooded and cynical. But this is deeply upsetting. It is a real hit to the gut. And sure, I've been watching, and yeah, I listen to my own coverage. I recognize the way the establishment Democrats have controlled the process, limited Sanders on virtually every front, checked him in many significant ways. And in a moment, we'll get to the latest theories about the gaming of the Democratic primaries this year. But even I was shocked that on a day when there were no votes cast, that the Associated Press decided that it had sufficiently pulled the delegates, the superdelegates, and decided that the inevitability was too much to manage and to constrain, and so they just had to release that information. Now, Kevin Gostola over at Shadowproof accurately characterized this as a massive act of malpractice. This is a real blow to what is left of participatory democracy in this country. And it will forever be a memory for people who supported Bernie Sanders in this uphill quest to win the Democratic nomination in 2016, that the media interrupted and declared Hillary the winner before the primary contests are over. And this calculation, the so-called magic number, as the New York Times euphemistically called it, is a crock of shit. Because as of today, Hillary Clinton has 1,811 delegates to Bernie Sanders' 1,526. Those are pledged delegates. There's 714 remaining. And it is anybody's guess how today's numbers will turn out. Now, based on the polls and the trends, it does look like Hillary Clinton could reach 2383 without superdelegates by the end of the night tonight, possibly even with the opening round from New Jersey. But it hasn't happened yet. And it would be, for example, like ESPN declaring that based on the first two games of the NBA playoffs, that the Cleveland Cavaliers don't have a prayer, and we're just going to save everybody the time and effort of watching the rest of the playoffs and give the award to the Golden State Warriors. It is that atrocious. Only if it happened in organized sports, pro sports like that, we would have riots in the streets like the Timbuk3 song suggests. And we certainly know that we have been getting screwed, those of us who believe in an open process and hope that democracy could actually work in this country. But we didn't imagine that they would end this so abruptly and in this manner. And it's all based on the likelihood that the superdelegates on July 25th will vote as they have said they will vote. And there's a lot of time between now and July 25th. And with the issues that dog Hillary Clinton, the email scandal that we have covered in some detail, the conflicts of interest with the Clinton Foundation, and those are just the recent problems of her own creation. Not to mention her bad policies about war and peace, her hawkish tendencies, her advocacy for the overthrow of Gaddafi, her championing putting U.S. troops into Syria to protect the interests of Israel. These are really serious issues, and the superdelegates are the people we will look to in the future when we look back and say what a blunder it was to put all bets on Hillary Clinton in the early part of June of 2016. But that's what's happening. Our voices are being trumped. And I can use that term because I play bridge. But they are being trumped by the eagerness of the superdelegates to get this over with. And they all believe that Hillary's entitled to this and that she's somehow going to survive the scandals that she has created. But if we just look at the past week of how erratically and irrationally Donald Trump has operated, and she's going to ride that bucking bronco and defeat him in the fall? I have grave doubts about that. And one of the claims is that because Hillary won Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands over the weekend, that plus the polling of superdelegates gave the Associated Press all of the data it needed to declare that she has clinched the nomination. And as soon as that happened, like lemmings, the cable networks all fell into line. And I heard them on MSNBC. They trotted out John Lipinski, who is their statistician, their director of elections, something like that. And he was wobbling all over the place, trying to explain how NBC knew this, but once the AP confirmed it, that they rechecked their own numbers and they decided it was safe to make the same declaration. And these media outlets have no sense of independence, no sense of propriety. That it's just really bad form and bad for the country for them to be rushing to announce this projected result well before it becomes a reality. And the Sanders campaign, clearly stunned by this, announced it's unfortunate that the media, in a rush to judgment, are ignoring the Democratic National Committee's clear statement that it's wrong to count the votes of superdelegates before they actually vote at the convention this summer. Secretary Clinton does not have and will not have the requisite number of pledged delegates to secure the nomination. She'll be dependent on superdelegates who do not vote until July 25th and who can change their minds between now and then. They include more than 400 superdelegates who endorsed Clinton 10 months before the first caucuses and long before any other candidate was in the race. Now, the Sanders campaign is pledging to just keep on going to the convention. But they've also tipped that Bernie is going home to Vermont tonight. So even if he wins California, it appears he's not going to be here to soak up that victory. And it is time for what politicians call a reassessment. And as you know, I'm split because I don't think Sanders will get any gratification as the number two candidate at the Democratic National Convention. Roseanne DeMauro, the fiery leader of National Nurses United, was rejected as a member of the platform committee, which has no members of organized labor on it. That's the drafting part of the platform committee. And that's just one example of the disrespect being shown to Sanders and his supporters. And so I think the Green Party option is still there. I know a lot of Democrats are queasy about that. I know a lot of people who just think that's, you know, too much of a high-risk flight of fancy. But to leave American voters with the Hobson's choice of Clinton or Trump in November, I still find that deeply unacceptable. I have shared with you the work of Bob Fetrakis and Cliff Arnbeck, mathematician Richard Charnin, and they claim that based on the differentials between the exit polls and the reported vote, in so many of the Democratic primary states to date, these numbers are so far out of kilter that there is a deep suspicion of election fraud. And I have some concurring voices here that I found online yesterday. I'm going to link to it in the show file for this podcast. And a report written by Giovanni and Marcello Pietrobon, who describe themselves as Italians who've been living in the United States for 20 years. They're both very scientific. One's a software engineer. The other's a microelectronic engineer. And they enjoy numbers. So they've taken a look at Richard Charnin's work, and they have evaluated the source of the exit poll data, the reliability of it, and they conclude thusly. In the 2016 Democratic primary elections, unadjusted exit polls show that Bernie Sanders has been robbed of the following percentage of votes. In Alabama, 6.1%. Arizona, 22.1%. Georgia, 5.5%. Massachusetts, 4.0%. Mississippi, 4.7%. Ohio, 5.0%. South Carolina, 5.2%. Texas, 4.2%. Wisconsin, 6.9%. West Virginia, 6.0%. New York, at least 5.9%. And they claim that based on running these numbers, that the odds of this happening without fraud are 1 in 77 billion. Now, as I say, you can read this report for yourselves. And I don't have a smoking gun. I don't have any evidence of direct tampering. All we can do is look at these numbers and wonder just how we got them. 24 out of 26 are in Hillary Clinton's favor, exceeding the margin of error in 11 primaries. And for example, in New York, they estimate the number of votes stolen is somewhere around 105,000. In Wisconsin, it's around 90,000. Same in Arizona. Ohio, about 60,000. Same in Texas. And they also show where they believe there was rigging involved, like Missouri, where as the votes are tabulated, the lines that show declining support for Sanders and increasing support for Clinton are fairly perfect lines. And human behavior doesn't always match up with that kind of perfect analysis. And they particularly single out Arizona and New York as the scene of likely election fraud. And then they go from there into a speculative mode. And I want to be clear about this, because with all of the vote theft that they claim, they say that Clinton still shows up with a lead of about 1.3 million votes. But they say, if you take into consideration that voter rolls were manipulated, long lines and severely shortened polling station hours reduced voter turnout, then they just kind of arbitrarily, it looks like to me, add 10% to Sanders' votes and subtract 5% from Clinton's. And that would put Sanders in the lead with about 780,000 votes. Now, again, I want to underscore that last part is speculative and the first part is not. And this is not speculation either. The FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server and the related issues, still very active, because the FBI went to court to file a second secret declaration. And this is in response to lawsuits brought by Vice News, Jason Leopold, and their lawyers. And in seeking to get a hold of Clinton documents related to the email issues, the FBI has told the court that, we have an ongoing investigation, and we don't want to disclose on the public record, which would compromise information that the FBI seeks to protect. So the secret declaration was written by the FBI's FOIA chief, and he wrote a public declaration submitted to the court. He said the Bureau cannot even disclose the to from dates and their contents in two pieces of correspondence from the FBI to the Department of State, nor could the FBI reveal the total volume of responsive information about Clinton's server without compromising the probe. So they also dodged the question of whether the investigation is criminal in nature, saying that we don't have to tell you that. That's not exactly what they said, but I'll save you the trouble. And the statement from the FBI said this is an active and ongoing investigation. The FBI is continuing to assess the evidentiary value of any materials retrieved for the investigation, and disclosure of any evidence or potential evidence could compromise that ongoing investigation. Meanwhile, the Trump circus is still raging out of control, and his scurrilous racist attacks on the judge presiding over the Trump University class action suit here in California have raised hackles, even of people who are grudgingly supporting Donald Trump. And the guy who's really squirming is Speaker Paul Ryan. He said that the comments by Trump meet the textbook definition of a racist comment. "I disavow these comments. I regret those comments that he made," said Paul Ryan. "Claiming a person can't do their job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment. I think that should be absolutely disavowed. It's absolutely unacceptable. But do I believe that Hillary Clinton is the answer? No, I do not." So he is sticking with a man that he has just labeled a racist, because that would be better than Hillary. And then with repeated questioning, he said, "Well, I don't know what's in his heart. I absolutely disavow these comments. The thinking behind it is something I don't personally relate to. But at the end of the day, this is about ideas. This is about moving our agenda forward." And so this, again, on the Republican side, is a Hobson's choice. Do you follow a demagogue who is off the charts and out of control and willing to make racist comments and double down on them? And Republicans are stuck with him. This is a very, very ugly election cycle. Every day I like to stop for a moment and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Tom Burkhart, who just... Just renewed his annual subscription. Casey Condon, a monthly subscriber, along with DGL Engraving. Thank you, DGL. And I just want to thank all the people who support my work. You make a big difference and affirm what I do, and you help to cover the costs of the podcast operation and my phone bills and all this other stuff. So if you're not a subscriber, it's your turn. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button and then become a subscriber. And if you choose the $50 annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., I will reward you with a bonus book, and your choices are available on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. And for newsbud.com, we have released our first weekly video report, anchored by yours truly. And if you haven't seen it yet, I linked to it in yesterday's podcast, so what the heck, I'll link to it again today to make that easy for you. You can also go to youtube.com and just enter Newsbud Report, and it'll come up for you quite easily. We have 14 days to go, and we need $34,200 to complete our first round goal. You know what's needed. If you've already donated, thank you. If you can do it again, feel free. And if that's not an option for you, please share the new video with your friends and networks and ask them to support Newsbud. It's really critical. Jeremy Scahill published a book recently called The Assassination Complex, and I haven't read the book, but I picked up an excerpt at Alternet, which is quite revealing. And the big takeaway is that during one 4.5-month period, nearly 90% of the people killed in drone strikes were not the intended targets. And Scahill analyzes the weak rules that are used to put somebody on a kill list, the standards of what imminent means and imminent threat, and the time it takes to get processed through Obama's kill meetings, the Tuesday video conferences, Then the target is placed on what's called a baseball card, which is just a thumbnail file of that person. And then it takes, in some cases, about 60 days to find the person and snuff them from the drone. And Scahill also reveals that far too many of the targets are based on signals intelligence, meaning that they attack a cell phone, presuming that it is in the pocket of the individual that they're trying to kill. But during January 2012 and February 2013, Special Operations airstrikes killed more than 200 people in northeastern Afghanistan, and of those, only 35 were the intended targets. So this is a very serious issue. It's never gotten properly reviewed or vetted by Congress, and the American public just sits back and acts like it's an action movie that they cannot resist. The FBI is stepping up its use of the sting operations that I'm so critical of, and the New York Times, apparently just discovering this, put Eric Lichtblau on the case, and he did a good job of summarizing cases that we have described to you here before. These are cases where the FBI inserts a paid undercover informant into an individual or a cell that they have identified through monitoring of social media or infiltrating mosques. And the use of these paid informants and provocateurs is increasing. Now, the FBI says that hasn't happened intentionally. They're just following the increased cases of people who are sympathetic to the Islamic State and want to go there and pick up arms with them. And as I mentioned yesterday, I have a hard time understanding how that is a crime. And they really stretch the law, first to frame these people and then to convict them. In one case, Rochester, New York, a paid informant went undercover, drove a man suspected of being an extremist to a Walmart to buy a machete, ski masks, zip ties, and other supplies for a planned terrorist attack on New Year's Eve. The suspect, a mentally ill panhandler, had no money, and so the informant paid for all of that gear. In North Carolina, the undercover agent pressed a suspect on whether he was willing to commit acts of terrorism for the Islamic State. "Do you think you can kill?" he said before giving him a silencer for an AR-15 assault rifle. There are more than 40 agencies who use covert operatives to investigate all kinds of things, and the FBI is number one. And no court has yet overturned one of these cases for entrapment, which is pretty obvious to the untrained eye, at least in my opinion. Here's another case in Miami that just ended last month. 40-year-old James Medina, a Muslim convert, might have been considering attacking a synagogue. In a meeting with an undercover informant and several other men, he accused a friend of wanting to blow up a synagogue. But 5 days later, as he was driving with his FBI informant in a suburb of Miami, he pointed to a synagogue and what he called David's Triangle Star on the outside. The FBI informant suggested attacking the synagogue during the Jewish holiday 2 weeks later. And Medina responded, "Now that'll be a good day to go bomb them." So then the informant took the plot a step further, introducing Medina to an acquaintance who was experienced with explosives, he said. That was actually another FBI undercover agent who asked Medina several times whether he really wanted to do this. And then when Medina accepted what he was told was a bomb and started to drive toward the synagogue, they busted him. And this is a pattern that has happened repeatedly. Trevor Aronson published a book 3 years ago which detailed over 500 cases of FBI frame-ups, in my opinion, and it is a trend that has proceeded without any real impediment or oversight. Yesterday, we reported to you that Vice News published more than 800 pages of declassified NSA documents, trying to find out whether Ed Snowden told the truth when he said that more than 10 times he tried to raise alarms with superiors about what he considered to be the illegal operations of the NSA. And it's interesting because Vice, in its first report yesterday, said that Snowden had declined to comment and that his attorney had said he was ambivalent about discussing these matters because he thinks the agency is still playing games. Well, After the report was published, Snowden took to Twitter. He at one point tweeted, "Interesting that this still shows an incomplete history of the concerns I expressed. Was it simple incompetence, or did NSA destroy records?" And this, you know, I find this interesting because Snowden knew that as a contractor, he had no real whistleblower protection, but he did attempt to go through channels, as has been retroactively advised by people like, oh, Senator Feinstein. Over in Syria, the battle for Raqqa is shaping up. And what's interesting is that U.S.-backed forces are moving in on Raqqa from the northern area, while Russian-backed forces with the Syrian army has started to move in on Raqqa from kind of the southern exposure there. And it's being backed by intense Russian airstrikes. And this is a very uncomfortable situation for the U.S. military, to be sure. And the U.S. denies that there are any ongoing consultations with the Russians. This is just coincidence that they're going after Raqqa at the same time our Kurdish U.S.-backed forces are attempting to roust the Islamic State. So the Pentagon says, in terms of direct coordination, that is not happening. I know there have been discussions about changing that, but at this point our position is the same. But over there at the Russian Defense Ministry, quote, "We exchange information with the United States on a daily basis, twice a day." That's all I can say. The carnival of coup and impeachment continues in Brazil, and it is just messier every day. The temporary president, Michel Temer, who's been banned from seeking elective office for 8 years, has suffered a fresh blow, because the lead prosecutor in the nation requested the arrest of four of the most powerful members of his party. One includes the leader of the House, the lower house, named Eduardo Cunha. He was put on suspension because he's under investigation for his own corruption. But three others are being sought: the Senate chief, the former president, and the party's leader of PMDB. In the upper house. All three have been implicated by leaked recordings suggesting that they were trying to use their new influence to block the car wash corruption investigation. And under the Brazilian system, the Supreme Court must now decide whether these politicians can actually be arrested. And meanwhile, Dilma Rousseff is basically on house arrest in the presidential palace in Brasilia. And finally today, a local case here in the Bay Area is drawing national outrage. Brock Turner, a former Stanford University swimmer who has been convicted of rape of an incapacitated woman who he did not know, well, it has taken an unusual turn because the judge in the case sentenced Brock Turner to only 6 months in prison. And the minimum should have been 2 years. The maximum was up to 14 years. But the judge, feeling sorry for this former Stanford swimmer, said that, gosh, you know, this could really ruin his life. That's not exactly what he said, but that's the sentiment that he expressed. And so he gave him a very light sentence. The judge said, this is the quote, "A prison sentence would have a severe impact on him." Well, the victim in this case, known to us only as 23-year-old Emily Doe, has fought back. At sentencing of Brock Turner last week, she unloaded a blistering statement, and she read it directly to Turner and, you know, looked him in the eye as she did so. And most people may have seen this. It's circulating online. It's gone wildly viral. And the online version is longer than what she read in the court. It's a total of 12 pages. And it is extremely powerful. And she explains what he did to her in a 20-minute drunken encounter behind a dumpster on the Stanford campus. And if it weren't for two women who were riding by on bicycles and witnessed it and turned Turner in, there may have never been even a criminal case here. So there are petitions to suspend the judge, to either recall him. He apparently is on the ballot in Santa Clara County today, And this may have happened so quickly that it's hard for people to organize to try to defeat him. But the way these elections work in California, they're called retention elections. And so you can't actually vote for an opponent. You basically fail to retain a judge. And if enough people do that, he would lose his position, which happens in California almost never. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. We give it away free, and you're free to share it with absolutely everyone. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.